for a lecture on a subject we don't hear much about at the Institute, Chinese painting. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to remind you that if you would like to become one of the 1,000 or so members of the Institute, there is a gentleman sitting outside who is more than happy to take your money, and we're extending memberships bought tonight to next autumn as well for the coming year, and they are tax deductible, so got a 4 weeks from tonight till those are due. It's a particular pleasure tonight to have with us Professor James Cahill, who is the leading scholar in Chinese painting in North America. He was born at Fort Bragg, California, not the Fort Bragg, South Carolina, but California, and received his BA in Oriental Languages from the University of California at Berkeley in 1950, and his MA and PhD in Art History from the University of Michigan. Before that, however, he spent time in the American military, in the army in Japan, where he also learned Japanese. He studied with Shujiro Shimada at Kyoto University in 1954-55 on a Fulbright after holding a museum training fellowship at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and then worked in Stockholm on a 7-volume work with Oswald Siren, Chinese painting leading masters and principals. He has been all over the place because after that he went to Washington, D.C. and was curator of Chinese paintings at the Freer Gallery of Art. In 1965, he became professor in the history of art at the University of California at Berkeley and served there until his retirement in 1994. In 1995, the College Art Association awarded him its Lifetime Distinguished Teaching Award for Art History. And in 2004, its annual meeting was devoted to him with papers by colleagues and former students. His list of publications would take the rest of our evening to read to you, but some of you who are interested in Chinese art would certainly be aware of his widely read and much reprinted Chinese painting in the Skira series, 1960, as well as many other books and exhibition catalogs and dozens of articles in both scholarly journals and in popular publications. Translations of his books have been published in Chinese, Japanese, and Korean, as well as several European languages. He has taught at Harvard University and at Princeton. He's given the Getty Institute lectures at the University of Southern California. And his book, The Compelling Image, Nature and Style in 17th Century Chinese Painting, was awarded the College Art Association's Mori Prize as the best art history book of 1982. He is still working on a variety of subjects in Chinese paintings. Alas, he's not going to talk to us tonight about one of them, Chinese erotic painting, but he is going to talk to us about another subject that has been near and dear to his heart, that has somewhat revolutionized our view of Chinese painting. Chinese painting, the realities behind the ideals. It gives me great pleasure to welcome to the Vancouver Institute tonight Professor James Cahill.
Thank you, Professor Williams. Great honor to be here speaking in this prestigious series, and especially before a remarkable audience. But a long time since I've talked to so many people, and some of them old friends among them. Yeah, the slides are already on the screen, so I can just start talking. Before I can turn to the main matter of my lecture this evening, I need to establish some background, explain what the ideals were and how they were arrived at. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the basic issues of Chinese painting, which I assume are most of you. And I apologize to those of you who know it already, for whom it will be repetitive. In the early centuries, up to the early late 13th century or so, most Chinese paintings, the best, were done by full-time professional artists who were typically trained in some old, earlier master studio, where they learned representational skills, how to make a good picture, And they were praised for their technical proficiency, for their profound understanding of their subjects that infused their images. This great early period culminates in the Song Dynasty, and particularly the Imperial Academy of the Song Dynasty, from the 10th to the end of the 13th century. These are two paintings from that period. The one on the right in the Shanghai Museum is an anonymous, here we go, sorry, backwards, anonymous picture of bamboo, old tree, and rock. An extraordinary lifelike picture, as if made by nature, as has been written about it, not a product of the hand of man. It's like some Northern European or Flemish or Dutch painting in that regard. On the other side, by a painter in the Imperial Academy named Cui Bo, this one has a signature and a date corresponding to 1061, and it shows a hare which has happened upon the nest of two jays, and they're chattering down, trying to drive it away. Dramatic incident, you might say, in nature. Both of them, anyway, give a powerful sense of objectivity, of close observation. And this is the main, shall we say, criterion for value in early Chinese painting, high-level representational technique. Now, let's see. Here we go. So this works. Yeah. A few more, just to remind you of some of the greatness of early Chinese painting, and to give others some sense of it. A painting of deer in an autumn forest, one of a pair of paintings, the hole on the right, detail on the left, originally probably parts of a screen, flat screen, panels of a screen. 10th or 11th century in date, superb works, portraying the animals as if they were occupied in their own concerns, unaware of being watched. Again, an extraordinary objectivity, marvelous drawing of the animals, some use of shading, as you can see, for volume. By the way, the white leafage here, or yellow, and certain other things, it's because when the painting was mounted on the screen, they could put on pigment very heavy, almost like relief. The Japanese do that in their screens, as you know. And then when they remount it as a scroll and unroll it and roll it, then all that flakes off, and all you have left is the underdrawing. That's why, anyway. Two paintings from the late Song period. Early 13th century. On the left, a painting of a traveler in winter who pauses on his path to listen to the sounds of the waterfall. And you can barely see them gibbons in the tree up here. Anyway, there's a wonderful sort of tie of sound between the man and the waterfall and the gibbons. And space, which by this time the Chinese artists have collectively managed to achieve a wonderful handling of space, and they use it for emotional evocations and resonances like this. The fan painting over here represents an imperial concubine or consort being awakened in the middle of the night. The emperor has sent for her and she's here being awakened. Someone out here is picking a flower to put in her hair. The women back here carrying musical instruments are going to accompany her to the emperor. Anyway, a lovely little picture, fan painting, originally mounted on a fan. At this time, paintings with a kind of narrative or quasi-narrative content were very highly valued, stories and paintings. In later periods, this wasn't allowed, or scarcely allowed, in respectable painting. You couldn't put stories and pictures anymore. The Chinese came to regard this as low class, for reasons we'll see. It was more or less ruled out of respectable painting. Not unlike, really, what happens in the early 20th century with us. Through the 19th century and British painting others, you had a lot of narrative painting where you could read the story. And then somewhere in the early 20th century, this becomes suddenly impossible. You can't do it anymore. Song paintings of that kind were still treasured and valued. Here are some. This is a painting by a 16th century artist named Xu Ying. I'll come back to him later. Anyway, some connoisseurs sitting around enjoying antiquities. And this person is about to inscribe an inscription or a colophon, not on the painting, but on the mounting, probably. At any rate, the fan would be taken off the fan and mounted in albums like this for preservation. So paintings in these old styles were still very much valued along as antiquities, along with ancient bronze vessels and other finely made objects. But the main course of painting had moved elsewhere by this time. This, as I say, is a painting by Chu Ying, early to mid-16th century. In the Yuan dynasty, the dynasty that followed, the dynasty in which China was ruled by the Mongols, later 13th, 14th century, this old professional tradition of painting, which produced the pictures we've been looking at, is challenged and eventually eclipsed in the eyes of most critics as the mainstream of Chinese painting by a movement made up of scholar amateur or literati artists. The literati were the people who were learned in China, who got government positions if they studied hard and passed the examinations and so on. Men who studied the classics, aimed at careers as government officials, and painted only as an avocation, at least in principle, not as a profession. Their predecessors in the Song dynasty, whose surviving works are rare, include the great Su Shi, or Su Dongpo. I'm sure many of you know him. 11th century statesman, poet, calligrapher, everything, and sometime painter. About the only thing that survives from him, this probably is okay, is this painting in the Shanghai Museum, very much retouched and damaged, of an old tree, twisted tree, and rocks, and a little bit of bamboo down here. No fine technique here, no fine detail, no color, ink on paper, very simple materials. His friend Mi Fu, who was also a great calligrapher, writes of him that, quote, "The trees and rocks in his paintings are all twisted up like sorrows in his breast." This represents a new attitude toward expression in painting, of the kind we might call expressionist. In other words, we're expressing something in the painter, in the artist, rather than depicting something in nature primarily. Obviously it does both, but anyway. The other one on the left is old tree and bamboo, shorthand scroll, again ink on paper by Wang Tingyun, who was a 12th century official and scholar, amateur artist. And a contemporary writer in an inscription composed for it says that, quote, "Looking at the painting, we feel as though we were seeing the man himself," end quote. This, as I say, is a very different version of expression in painting from what we began with. It de-emphasizes the subject. It puts the emphasis on the hand of the artist, on forms that somehow reflect his mind, embody his thoughts and feelings. In principle, these men very seldom women, I have to say, so I'm going to go on saying he and men and so on. There are women painters, and they're a very interesting group, and a former student of mine and others did an exhibition of them and so on, but this doesn't fit into tonight's lecture. In principle, these men painted for pleasure and self-cultivation and never sold their works or used them for gainful purposes. Their true vocation was scholarship and service in the government bureaucracy. They devised a whole new set of principles for how the best painting should be judged. Technique and subject matter were devalued, not what you were supposed to look for or pay attention to in painting. Subjects in scholar amateur painting were limited to those that stood for high-minded virtues. Some of you know about that. Bamboo and old plum and all these things had sort of symbolic value. Deliberately non-entertaining, no stories. I have sometimes put the Su Dongpo picture over here beside the painting in Shanghai we started with, which was that really superb image of bamboo and old trees and rocks in winter, and have said, pointed out that any traditional Chinese connoisseur given a choice would immediately take this one, the Su Dongpo. This is high-class painting. The other has gone down through the centuries neglected. No seals or inscriptions on it. Okay, that's something we have to recognize in Chinese painting, whether we immediately understand it or not. The principal figure in this movement, the scholar amateur movement in the early Yuan period, the 13th and beginning of the 14th century, is a man named Zhao Mengfu. Two famous paintings of his, a picture, another of rocks and trees and old bamboo, on the right, and on the left, a section of a landscape by him, done in very dry, crumbly brushstrokes, very simple, hardly any line drawing, a few houses and a bridge or two, but a very simple, plain painting. He was a scholar official who served under the Mongol Emperor Kublai Khan. He was an outstanding poet and calligrapher as a painter. The literacy and the general cultivation of these men, so the theory went, was manifested in their paintings and made them better in the eyes of true connoisseurs than the technically superior works of the professional artists. It's not coincidental that the men who spread this doctrine, who wrote the books and controlled the press, so to speak, were themselves members of the literati class and understandably biased toward that version of the matter. So what we have in the literature is very heavily pro-amateur artist. And this becomes, most traditional Chinese connoisseurs and collectors would say, the mainstream, the main thing of Chinese painting. Perhaps a little hard to understand, but anyway, we have to. Two works. I'm sorry. Some of the slides I brought from Berkeley recently got cracked on the way. I'm sure you have to put up with a couple cracks. That's one. Okay. Two works by an artist named Ni Zhan, working late in the Yuan Dynasty. It is 1345, the one on the left, and 1372, the one on the right. He began his life as a rich young member of a landowning gentry family, famous or notorious for his nearly pathological insistence on cleanliness and everything and everyone around him. He was always washing things or having things washed. He, of course, painted only for pleasure. Although he never attempted an official career, he became another model for the scholar amateur artist, for whom painting was in theory something he did in his leisure time as a mode of self-cultivation, along with practicing calligraphy, composing poetry, playing the qin or zither. These were the polite arts in which the gentleman could properly engage. He was not interested in payment. He gave his works freely to his friends and others, expecting no recompense. So it is in theory, at least, in principle, and how probably in his case it may have been very largely true. Later in the Yuan, the revolts and the disorders of the late period of the dynasty forced Ni Zhan to dispose of his land and take to a wandering life, in which he stayed with various people. He would travel by water, typically, and stay for days or so with some person who were more settled and secure, and would repay that person by painting pictures for them. And the pictures were always this very, very simple landscape. That is, a foreground bank, a few very sparse-looking trees, a little tingzhou, or not pavilion, I don't know, whatever, kiosk, and then distant hills. And that's his formula. And he does that over and over and over again. And he uses it, presumably, to depict this person's, his host's villa. And the pictures all look the same. In fact, this one was actually converted. He inscribed it for one person first, and then that person gave it to somebody else. And he re-inscribed it as a picture of that second person's home and reclusion, so to speak. Although he did this to repay his hosts, this was regarded as an expedient that was forced on him by circumstance, and it didn't erode his amateur status or give his paintings any taint of commercialism. His paintings are considered to embody or to express the fastidiousness of his personality and his withdrawal from a contaminated world. And so the ideal was born and became so pervasive that eventually it was impossible to praise a painter for his technical skills or for painting emotionally engaging pictures. No stories were permitted in his works. I mean, a really respectable, prestigious painter. Lifelikeness, verisimilitude, xingsi in Chinese. Lifelikeness in painting was ranked the lowest on the scale of qualities to look for, along with fine technique. These were thought to be ways of making your picture attractive to the eyes of people who didn't really know very much, who were not connoisseurs. And therefore, it was sullied by commercial motives. You wanted to sell your pictures. And again, we have that attitude today somewhat. There are artists who simply won't make a saleable work because that somehow, well, you know that, all right. Now, the self-expressive version of painting or account of painting in which the painting expresses the artist's character and feelings and all the rest of it works well enough in the case of a Ni Zhan. He paints a certain kind of dry, austere landscape to express his passion for cleanliness and his lofty mind. This is not, of course, a really adequate version of painting, and if we were talking in terms of art theory, I certainly wouldn't use it. But let's say okay for now. But when in the late Ming and early Qing dynasties in the 17th century, a whole school of artists working in this style, roughly Ni Zhan style, dry, brush, line, simple scenery, and so on. When a whole school of artists working the style arises in Anhui province, I'm not using maps, but you have to imagine upstream from Shanghai, Suzhou, and so on, inland a bit, Anhui province. All of them painting landscapes in this austere, dry brushwork manner associated with Nizan and other Yuan period masters, then the self-expressive account of painting won't work, because you can't imagine a whole school of artists who are all obsessively cleanly and high-minded and all the rest of it. Obviously, wouldn't work. So then, in a seminar and exhibition, which I'll speak of in a moment, my students and I came up with an economic account of this. And I'm really oversimplifying. I don't believe and never believe you can have single causes for phenomena in art, so don't get me wrong. But something like this, anyway. This is at least a big factor in the popularity of this kind of painting. Paintings of this kind, we argued, were sought after especially by a rising merchant class centered in Anhui province, the so-called Huizhou merchants. And they were, many of them, what we would call nouveau riche, perhaps. Not all, but a lot of them were. And they saw paintings of this kind as emblems of gentry elite values, of the kind they wanted to claim for themselves or buy into. The greatest of the Anhui schoolmasters was the painter Hongran, whose works these are. Both these are Hongran paintings. Well, in the Yuan dynasty, there was a saying that in the area where Nizan worked, that the high class or low class of a family, their refinement or their vulgarity, could be judged by whether they owned a Nizan painting or not. If they did, they were high class, if they didn't, so on. The same thing is said of Hongran in his period, in the 17th century. And so these become status symbols, if you want to use that word, something like that. They're supposed to show that you are the kind of person who can appreciate this kind of painting, and ideally that you were close enough to the artist that the artist gave you one. But then that, again, is a kind of idealized account, as I'll explain later. In 1980 to 81, I organized a graduate student seminar at Berkeley, an exhibition of Anhui school painting at our university art museum. The catalog titled Shadows of Mount Huang has been recognized as groundbreaking in exploring how economic and social history and regional factors affected painting. A copy of the catalog was taken by a colleague to China, where it inspired, as they later told us, the first international symposium on Chinese painting held in China at Hefei, Anhui province, in 1984. Lesser masters of the Anhui school, such as Wang Zhurui on the right, needed only to reproduce the basic Nizan formula in elegant line to produce an acceptable picture. That is about as simple as you can get. He has carried Nizan further. Here are the trees, and here's the little Tingzi, and here's the distant hill, and so on. Better artists, of course, did more than that. At the left, a painting by Zheng Min. Until recently, a fairly little-known artist, but he's come to some prominence lately. Zheng Min, who creates new and interesting works within the Nizan style. Zheng Min is especially important to our subject tonight because of the recent discovery of the manuscript of his diary. And this was presented at the symposium in 1984 by the discoverer, Chinese scholar. I use the case of Zheng Min to open my 1994 book on the economics of Chinese painting, The Painter's Practice, How Artists Lived and Worked in Traditional China, because he so nicely exemplifies what I'm talking about. A conventional account of him written by a contemporary reads like this, quote, "The master immerses himself in old books, not caring whether it is cold or hot, living tranquilly, uttering few words, his mind fixed on distant goals, that is unconcerned with day-to-day affairs. His painting style is lofty and antique, completely following the spirit consonance mode of expression. Accordingly, he can rival the grand masters. In the most refined of his works, whether feelings of sadness and melancholy or complaint and anger, if these were not aroused by his great talents, then they must come from his own experiences. That is to say, he paints to express his feelings, and he isn't concerned with worldly matters." Just to, no, let's see. Left. Yeah. Oh, no, wrong. Let's see if the reverse works. Yes, it does, thank goodness. Okay, this then. Yeah. Another painting by Zheng Min. I just changed it to have something different on the screen. Rather wetter style, but still the same kind of simple scenery. But from Zheng, excuse me, From Kung Min's diary, we get a very different picture, in which he hurries around fulfilling commissions, leaving paintings with a go-between to sell for him, responding to the requests and demands of his patrons. A line of poetry comes to him, quote, "To get through the year, I need the income from selling my paintings." And after New Year's, he congratulates himself on managing to repay his obligations with this meager income. So, here in its starkest form, then, is the great disparity between ideal and reality. We arrive at last at the real matter of my lecture, and some of you will be thinking at last, it's about time. The problem, as I stated earlier, is that it was no longer possible to praise an artist, any painter, even the most unambiguously professional one, except by turning him into an amateur. The terms had been lost. They simply didn't apply anymore. You couldn't praise somebody for being technically skillful or painting good pictures or any of that. A contemporary of Dai Jin, this is a work by Dai Jin on the left, Cleveland Art Museum, a contemporary of Dai Jin, the great professional master of the 15th century, describes him as one who, quote, takes pleasure in poetry and, just a minute, poetry and calligraphy as a means to pursue the Tao, or the way, and splashes ink with a brush in order to delight his heart, end quote. At left is a typical Dai Jin, which could hardly be produced by splashing ink to, you know, delight your heart. And there's no evidence known to me, moreover, that Dai Jin was interested in either poetry or calligraphy. These are just conventional attributes of the literatus artist, which he wasn't. In the late Ming, Dong Qichang, whom we'll hear more later, describes his contemporary Wu Bin, whose 1617 monumental landscape is on the right, describes him as a lay Buddhist who, quote, painted in his leisure time, end quote. Wu Bin was a prolific master. I've worked quite a lot on him. Producing a large number of big, elaborate landscapes like this one on the right, many of which survive. He couldn't have done this in his leisure time. So these are well-intended misrepresentations of the artist's real situation. They mean to praise him, but they do it by falsifying his real circumstances, as if acknowledging his reality would demean him. How the artist felt about this kind of praise, we have no way of knowing. Once we recognize this great disparity between ideal and reality, we can go on to explore the true circumstances of the artist's lives. But here another problem arises. For the same reason, Chinese artists virtually never write about how the artist made his living, how he was paid for his work, and so forth. At a symposium back in the 1970s, I and others were sitting on the stage taking questions from the audience, and somebody in the audience asked a question about how did the artists live, how were they paid, what the relationship was with the patron. And I answered for the group saying that we simply didn't have enough evidence to answer this. We'd like to know, but we can't because the evidence isn't there. Well, technically true, because as I say, Chinese writers don't discuss the economics of Chinese painting. It was a taboo subject, really. On the other hand, there is information, but it's information that somehow slipped through the taboo. Occasional jottings, so-called sui bi writings, or inscriptions or letters from the artists or others. It's out there, but it's also scattered and in obscure places to make research very difficult. In 1980, Professor Zhujing Li, some of you know him, he comes to Vancouver every year, organized a symposium titled Artists and Patrons. The papers in that were mostly by young specialists who had recently finished theses on particular artists and schools and who gave detailed accounts of what they had learned about how their artists made their livings. These papers together gave a good beginning for our investigations in this direction. It turned out that we knew a lot more collectively than we had thought we did. In 1989, I myself held a seminar on this topic in Berkeley, attended by a group of graduate students, including, by the way, Xingyuan Zhao, who is now on your faculty, and several visiting Chinese scholars and museum curators who fortunately were there. And after laying out our subject and all the different things we wanted to know about, I sent them out on a kind of scavenger hunt to scan through lots of potential sources to find writings that offered clues to different aspects of our subject. Again, with the help of students, I turned all this into a big database and used that to put together a series of lectures delivered at Columbia University, were published in 1994, as the book mentioned earlier, The Painter's Practice, How Artists Worked in China. I recommended to you a book full of amusing anecdotes. tells you a lot about the subject in case you want to read more. It's available in low price paperback now. I should add here that around the time I came to Berkeley, which was 1965, as Professor Williams said, the practice of art history was going through a great change. From studies of style in the great German tradition, style along with documentation and iconography and the artist's biographies and so on. Okay. Is it too loud? Okay. Okay, yes, yes, okay. I'm going to take this out then. Sorry. I didn't realize there was a sound problem. I'll talk into this. Okay. Is that better? Can I be heard better? What?
Yeah, the battery's dying.
Can I be heard better now? Yes?
I can tell.
No.
I'll turn it up louder.
Louder. Turn it up louder, yeah. Anyway, that was the kind of art history that had been done by my teacher, Max Lehrer, very well. But the study of art history was changing from that to a study of art in a social, political, economic context with attempts to find ways in which those factors affected the production of art. I and my students, surrounded by people who were doing that in exemplary ways for Western art, Svetlana Alpers, Michael Baxendall, some of you know some of them, tried to respond to this new direction. We were bored with stylistic studies by then anyway. Our approach, which was new and exciting then, has by now in turn become to seem rather old-fashioned, as art history studies, along with others, have turned to so-called theory. But that's a matter I don't mean to go into besides mentioning it. We were, that is, cutting edge then and were a bit old hat now. But okay, that's inevitable if one lives long enough. And I'm not really uncomfortable with it. Anyway, one preserved letter comes from a major artist, the early 16th century master Chiu Ying, one of the relatively few painters working in the old conservative tradition who was still recognized as a great master. And it was written in response to a request for a birthday meeting. He writes, quote, "Recently you favored me with an order to make a painting for a birthday celebration. It has been respectfully completed and is hereby presented for approval and acceptance. When you place another order, just send word to me and it will be done and delivered. But please do not place any more orders through Shi Chu. Although he and I are relatives, we do not get along at all. Please keep this in mind. The other two paintings will be delivered soon. Not yet recovered from an illness, that is, I have written this in too careless a hand. Hoping for your forgiveness, I am," and he signs, "Ying," who bows again, dated on the sixth day, and then he adds a postscript asking for some pills and medicinal leaves and saying he's returning the leftovers from the silk the man sent. From this letter, we learned about several things: that go-betweens were used in ordering paintings, that the client sometimes supplied the silk or paper for the painting, and that artists sometimes ask for gifts, the medicine, along with cash. In fact, gifts of any kinds are mentioned in records of transactions between artists and their clients. The painting that Chiu Ying did for this client probably looked something like this one, which he did for his principal patron, Xiang Yuanbian, who wanted to give it to his brother on his birthday. All kinds of auspicious imagery and wishes for long life were incorporated into the picture. Pine trees, thick clouds promising rain that is nourishing the earth, making it fertile, heavy mineral blue and green pigments, which refer to the azurite and malachite mountains of paradise. The figure at the bottom, walking here, walking beneath the pines, is the recipient of the painting. The artist signs modestly over here. We can't see it, really. Just a signature and a little more. Xiang Yuanbian, the brother, writes a longer inscription up above. Is that right? Yeah, good. The upper part of the painting, there's a pavilion where the recipient can imagine himself sitting to enjoy the cool breeze and gaze at the scenery. Paintings of this kind were commissioned, as in this case, from versatile artists who could provide a suitable work for whatever occasion. They worked in the old professional mode, but they were overshadowed in critical esteem by the scholar amateur artists, or artists who painted in the amateur styles even while making a living at it, like Zheng Min, we talked about a bit ago. They could be rewarded in cash or with gifts or sometimes with hospitality. Chiu Ying, like many professional artists, stayed with several hosts during various periods of his life. Six from a series of 12 hanging scrolls, Forming a Screen, painted in 1652, is a collaborative work by Chun Yuyen, a figure painter, and Lan Ying, a well-known late Ming landscapist. They placed the birthday picture in the center. You understand there's only half of it. It would have gone on half the same amount on the left. The person in the center, surrounded by beautiful women and respectful friends and symbols of long life. This was surely done on commission for somebody's birthday. Family members would explain their wishes to the artist, who would respond with the works that could be hung on the time of the birthday celebration. In this case, it's hard to imagine they would be hung very often after that. The 12 scrolls take up a big wall and would get pretty boring after a while. For the same reason, they've turned up several times in auction. Nobody seems to want to keep them because if you have a big wall, you don't want to give it to something like this. Another kind of painting presented and hung on the occasion of birthdays portrayed female immortals offering emblems or tokens of longevity, fungus and peaches and gourds of wine, etc., in effect wishing the recipient many happy returns. The leading figure painter of late Ming, Chun Hung Cho by name, did pictures of this kind with the help of studio assistants who are sometimes named in his inscriptions. These are two versions of such a composition, painted by Chun Hung Cho and his helpers in the Taipei and Beijing Palace Museums. Once we would have argued over which of either is a genuine work. Now we can recognize that they are two survivors from a multiple studio production. Another one, and still another, the upper part of another one, in private museum in Beijing. I'm not saying all these are genuine necessarily, but they might be. They're just done, as I say, in a kind of serial way by Chun and his studio. Rather heavy-handed routine works, probably kept in the studio for purchase by anyone who came in needing such a painting. Most of Chun Hong's pictures of this kind date from the 1630s, when he seems to have been active as an unambiguously professional master, having failed in his attempt to pass the examinations and become a scholar official. By this time, the number of men who aspired to office and studied for the examinations vastly exceeded the number of positions, and those who didn't make it had to find other ways to earn their livings, including painting. At other times of his life and under better conditions, especially in his late years, when he had become famous enough to have his work sought after by serious patrons, Chun Hung Cho could produce works of the kind that his fame rests on, such as the great series of scenes from the life of Tao Yuan Ming on the left, a hand scroll in the Honolulu Art Academy, painted in 1650. But even in this, he employed his son to do the coloring, according to his inscription. At the right, is his self-portrait in a landscape, painted in 1635, titled Immortal Under Tall Pines, and expressing in my reading of it a bitterness at failing to attain a place in officialdom and being forced to earn his living producing works that didn't represent his real sensitivity and originality. He places himself in an absurd landscape, a kind of extreme forced rendering of a professional type that was popular then, and in what amounts to a parody of the noble scholar in the landscape pictures. Just briefly, I'll show you pictures that were very detailed and elaborate, such as the famous Qingming Shangfutu in Beijing, the cityscape on the a section of it on the right, and the preliminary sketch for another one that's later on the left. Highly finished elaborate compositions of this kind, as done by professional and academy masters for rich and powerful patrons up to the emperor himself, usually requires that a detailed preliminary drawing be done in advance and presented to the ruler or the patron for his approval before the artist could go ahead with doing the finished version. Artist or artists, usually it might be a group project. It's often the same in Europe, as many of you know. Scholar amateur artists, of course, refuse to follow any such procedure. It would have been an unforgivable insult to have suggested, since it would hamper their creative freedom. It's particularly interesting to observe how factors of patronage in the market affected the style and the characters of the painting, character of the paintings. One of my seminars I described explored how Anhui school painters in the 17th century, working in large part for a newly arisen merchant class patronage, produced landscapes in dry, rather austere styles associated with the Yuan masters, especially Ni Zan, which had come, as I said, to stand as emblems of high literati culture. By the end of the 17th century and into the 18th, many of the people who had made their fortunes in Anhui had moved to Yangzhou, northwest of Nanjing, some of you have been there, where the super rich of the time, the salt merchants who had monopolies on the salt trade, also resided, along with a great many lesser merchants and officials and others of more moderate means who still wanted to acquire paintings. And of course, artists moved to where the patronage is most bountiful. Yangzhou quickly became the leading center of painting in China, and the production of painting is transformed in two ways. These are well explored in a recent book by my former student, Ginger or Cheng Shi Xu, called A Bushel of Pearls. Anyway, developed out of her dissertation. Many of the artists had supplied the demands of a larger number of upper and middle class clients, begin to paint less time consuming, more sketchy and repetitious pictures, so that they could turn them out in greater numbers and satisfy that demand. A painter named Joshua Biao, who begins in southern Anhui province, is a painter of serious landscapes in the Nizhan style, as you see in the one here on the left, moves to Yangzhou later in his life and takes to a prolific production of sketchier pictures, the example on the right. Another of my students found a verse of the time, or a ditty as she called it, in which she was paired with an equally prolific maker of inlaid lacquer plates named Zhang Qiushui. For plates in every place is Jiang Qiushui, for scrolls in every home is Joshua Biao, end quote. The great landscapist Gong Xian, who died in 1689, produced many of his finest works in his early and middle periods, such as the one on the left, dark, imposing, when he was living in Nanjing. They are executed with patient applications of ink, rather like stippling in Western art, a process through which you can build rich surfaces and achieve dramatic light and dark effects. To get from them a major monumental work like the one on the left here, a patron might have to support him for several months and pay him visits from time to time. Such a painting today might fetch a six-figure amount in an auction. In his late years, Gong Xian also moved to Yangzhou, where he also began to paint larger numbers of less time-consuming pictures, such as the one at right. And here's the detail from it. Well, using a fast-running line and looser dotting, as seen in the detail, these more quickly executed pictures had virtually no value in the Chinese market later, and many of them were exported to Japan in the 18th century. The Japanese liked them as commercial goods brought there by Chinese merchants. They were common enough in Japan, even to modern times, to fetch only low prices. This painting was now on the screen. I myself bought in Kyoto during my Fulbright year there, 1954-5, for the equivalent of $15. When I showed it to my teacher, Shimada Shujiro, he told me, who was a bit of a put-down, that it was a so-called tamegaki, a fast minor work done to repay some small favor. So there were many other reasons why an artist might do one kind of picture or another, use one or another style, expend more or less time on it. Even the masters of the academy, here are two of them from the middle Ming period, names don't matter, who painted big elaborate pictures for the court or for high-level patronage, like the one on the right, also painted simple, quickly executed pictures, such as the one on the left, for more casual gifts to repay small favors. A scroll containing a group of these latter minor gifts by academy masters was discovered some years ago in a tomb. This is one of them, so-called Huayan tomb paintings. Oops. Chinese scholars hailed them as proof that the same academy masters who did the big paintings also did smaller self-expressive paintings, what the Chinese call xie yi, sketching the idea. I wrote a piece arguing that it wasn't so much self-expression, more a matter of the status of the recipient and the painter's expected reward. Quick, simple works were used as minor gifts, as they are today. Every Chinese artist working in the traditional styles has a repertory of simple pictures he can do while you watch, and then he'll give it to you and expect something in return. These are not the paintings that are exhibited and treasured and passed down. That's why we know them only from the paintings in the tomb. They simply weren't preserved, weren't considered worthy of preservation. The greatest landscape master of the late Ming, Dong Xichang, did some of his finest work, such as the one on the left, around 1616 to 1617, when he was in serious financial straits after a mob of villagers had rioted and burned his estate. And he was forced, like Nizhan, to live with others and repay their hospitality with substantial paintings, to which he devoted a lot of time and thought. During his most settled and affluent years, later, he appears to have produced a great many lesser or minor works,
or had them ghost-painted by other artists. We use the term ghost-painted, like you use ghostwriter, done by somebody else and you get the credit. And on these, like this one here, he would typically write only his signature and the title and his signature, and then later, when he gave it to somebody, he would add a longer inscription dedicating it to that person. Zhong Xuchang and other painters who themselves held official positions often used their paintings as political gifts to gain favor with their superiors or to repay colleagues for favors done. This was all in accordance with the well-known Chinese system of guanxi, reciprocal exchanges of gifts and favors. Another notable example of a mismatch between ideal and reality is Zhu Da, or Ba Da Shanren, an eccentric artist active in the later 17th and early 18th century, who seems to have gone through a period of madness in midlife. And during his later years, he painted very odd pictures that could be read as reflecting that experience of insanity. A biographer of the time writes about him, quote, "He often used to pass his time at a Buddhist temple outside the town. When the novices there jokingly asked him for a picture, he did not resist, nor did he refuse when some scholar friend offered him a gift for a picture. But if highly placed people offered him a whole barrel of gold pieces, they got nothing. If they brought silk with them, he would take it without hesitation, but then what he would say, I shall make stockings out of it. For this reason, the highly placed people were accustomed to approaching the poor scholars, the mountain monks, or butchers and innkeepers, when they wanted pictures by Shanren, and to buy from them. But this is another idealized account meant to attribute to the artist a disdain for profit. Preserved letters from Ba Da Shanren reveal him accepting commissions, using go-betweens, accepting money and gifts for his works, engaged in the same practices, that is, as his contemporary Zheng Min and the rest. A Nanjing collector relates in a colophon to a Ba Da Shanren landscape album that he obtained it by sending a large sum of money to a go-between in Ba Da's hometown, Nanchang in Jiangxi province. And he was very happy with the album he received and remarked that Ba Da would never have given him the kind of rough and hasty sketches that he did to repay gifts from the Jiangxi salt merchants. The picture at the left can represent them. I described earlier how the flourishing of Yangzhou in the late 17th, 18th century as a new center of painting altered the circumstances under which paintings were typically produced and the nature of the paintings produced in two important ways. One of them, discussed earlier, was a shift in the mode of production. The old system of doing smaller numbers of one-of-a-kind, carefully planned paintings for particular patrons gave way to a more prolific output of simpler, sketchier pictures for middle-level, more casual producers. One of the Yangzhou masters, Zheng Xie, known to the Chinese as Zheng Panqiao, famously posted a price list on his door telling how much he charged for scrolls of. And Ginger Xu's researches showed that these prices were well within the reach of minor officials and other mid-level townsmen. The other great change was the abrupt decline of landscape as a subject in demand. Ginger discovered a saying of the time that went more or less, if you want gold, paint portraits. For silver, paint flowers. If you want to be a beggar, paint landscape. What seems to have happened is that merchant patrons, more secure in their status in society, to the point where they could now patronize the scholars, no longer felt the need to display their adoption of gentry literati values by acquiring symbols of them, and were free to indulge their own tastes, which lay elsewhere. Portraits are indeed popular, and a new type of highly informal portrait appears. Jin Dong, that's a detail on the right from a very informal portrait of Jin Dong done by his pupil, Lo Ping. Jin Dong was himself a famous artist of the time, and Lo Ping presents him here asleep in the garden. This continues into the later periods, a picture of a family escaping the summer heat by Run Bonian, later 19th century. Such pictures would have been impossible before, not tolerated by the artist's audiences, who wouldn't have dared to be seen enjoying them. Most in demand in Yangzhou were in the 18th century were plant subjects, and mostly those had symbolic value and could be used to send messages, often spelled out in the long inscriptions on them. The bamboo by Zheng Xie, or Zheng Panqiao, now on the right, the one who posted the price list, and on the left, a picture of blossoming plum by Jin Nung, which was painted to congratulate a friend who had acquired a new concubine. The blossoming plum, which flowers in late winter and early spring, stood for continuing vigor into old age. While the red color, as Jin Dong writes in his poetic inscription, represented her rouge, her cosmetics, her youth and beauty, old familiar themes could be given new and specific meanings. Pleasing paintings that carried messages people wanted to hear, who could ask for more? Zheng She endlessly painted his branches of bamboo in ink, sometimes with rocks and orchids, in response to a great diversity of occasions and requirements. Jin Dong painted blossoming plum branches by the hundreds, or had them ghost-painted for him. This practice, too, takes us into the modern period, when such a famous master as Chi Baisher mass-produced pictures of prawns and little chicks. Another artist who specialized in pictures of pandas turned those out prolifically, and so forth. Everyday life subjects, everyday life objects, that once had been considered too low class, became popular. This too continues to the present day. Li Shan, another Yangzhou master active in the mid-18th century, often did pictures of vegetables and fruits, accompanied by enjoyable inscriptions written in a free, relaxed calligraphy. The one on the left, a album leaf, watermelon and eggplant and leisure, is it? Anyway, was used for the cover of Ginger's book. The other one on the right, a hanging scroll, is an evocation of autumn. I'll put a detail on it, our last slide. Here we go. Yes. An evocation of autumn, a pea vine clinging to an old tree stump in one's garden, a cricket cage hanging from it, a cricket inside. Well, enjoyable as this is, nostalgic perhaps, within the long history of Chinese painting, it may nonetheless seem a falling off. Much of the grandeur and profundity of the best early work, such as the great Song period paintings we began with, has been lost. But so it is with European and American art, no more Titian or Velasquez or even Degas and Picasso. Landscapes are still being painted in China, but without much life or originality. But to do likable pictures of enjoyable subjects and sell them at reasonable prices so that most everybody can have one, how could anyone complain about that? And that brings us to modern times, when you and I can travel to China and bring back paintings by one or another of our favorite recent or contemporary artists without really being rich. If I were to continue, I'd begin to speak more about what has been lost in this great change, and I'd slip into a judgmental mode. Another fault of older art historians that upsets the younger and more progressive ones. So it's a good place to stop. Thank you.
Questions? As usual, we take questions for the speaker. Yes.
Could you explain the text that is on these pictures?
The what?
The text.
The text on the paintings?
Yes.
Oh, they can be all kinds of things. Sometimes they are simply poems written by the artist or by somebody else that somehow harmonize with the subject of the painting. They don't necessarily explain it. I've had people complaining about our exhibitions that there are inscriptions there that we don't bother to translate. Sometimes I answer they aren't going to tell us very much anyway. There's nice poems that are on there. On the other hand, there can be inscriptions that tell us a lot. They can be dedications to the person they're painting it for, or in the case of Jin Dong's painting, they can explain what the painting is about, what it really meant. Sometimes, for instance, Zheng She, the bamboo painter, could paint 10 bamboo pictures, and by writing different inscriptions on them, give them all different meanings. When he leaves his post up in Shandong to go back to Yangzhou in retirement, he paints bamboo and he says, now this is the fishing pole I'm going to use when I spend my late years fishing. And then he paints two bamboo and he uses it for a marriage. The two of them are somehow beautifully, etc. Inscription can be very valuable or not so important. Sometimes it's a simple signature of the artist. Of course we have to read them, but as I say, I've defended myself sometimes for not including complete translations of all of them in an exhibition catalog. Some of them could be not, too. Is that all right? Okay. What else?
Yes, at the back.
Yes? Yes.
That to make cultivated painting, you have to be a cultivated person.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an ethical idea that exists, I think, in the West as well.
Yeah.
Can you comment on that in relation to the reality behind the myth?
What the
question again?
Well,
that's part of
the question is, can a scoundrel make a good painting?
Oh, no. Well, scoundrel sort of misstates the point. If he's a cultivated scoundrel, yes. You can't. It's not so much whether he does good or bad works. It's rather the man's education, self-cultivation, or general cultivation, general culture, shall we say. And curiously, although that is endlessly preached in theory and inscriptions, in fact, the Chinese don't make the judgments purely on the quality of the man. For one thing, any one artist can do good and bad paintings. And in other words, it's something that works in theory. And a painter like Su Dong Po doubtless gets a lot more attention as a painter than he would if he were nobody. We have that kind of. We have Winston Churchill painting, but nobody tries to say that these are great paintings because he was a great statesman. It's a complicated thing, but in principle it's there, and it does work in practice to a certain extent. If you find a piece of a painting by somebody, as I say, who was famous in other ways, it will usually be valued more than a painting by nobody in particular. It's not a complete answer, but it should do. Yes?
Were there any political paintings?
Oh my, yes.
Artists make political comments.
Yes.
Question is, were there any political paintings?
Yes, indeed. I had a whole seminar on that, and a book I wrote, published in Kansas, University of Kansas, called Three Alternative Histories of Chinese Painting, has an essay on political painting. They normally were not protests. You couldn't easily protest China. You had to do it very subtly. But in the early Yuan period, for instance, there were paintings done that somehow, in a mysterious Chinese way, criticized the Mongols who had taken over the country and expressed their loyalism in subtle ways. Those are there. You can praise somebody, an official, for being good to the people by painting a picture, for instance, in a rainy landscape. That means rain nourishes the earth, that you are coming to administer these people like the rain that comes to save the farmers, and so on. There are lots of political reasons, but nobody thought about this until just a matter of a few decades ago. Again, this is not discussed by the Chinese writers. They know it, I think. I assume they know it. And obviously the artist did, and the artist's patrons did, but you don't find it discussed, because it somehow, again, distracts you from sheer quality and self-expression and all of that. There are lots of pictures of virtuous hermits, and the man who gives the painting to a certain official is likening him to the virtuous hermit. In principle, you're not supposed to want to be in office. You'd rather be out living in the mountains, but out of sheer,
Sense of duty,
perfectly. He goes and serves in the administration, and so on. Yeah, lots and lots of them. As I say, three alternative histories of Chinese painting. Yes?
When you compare the paintings you've shown
yes.
to Chinese ceramics, which are brilliant in color,
yes.
is that because the paintings were intended this way, or have the colors faded over the passing of time?
Well, first of all, the colors were used. The question. He's comparing paintings to Chinese ceramics, which were brilliant in color, and asking whether the colors on the paintings, which normally don't have as much color, whether that's because it's faded or somehow deteriorated. Is that the question, more or less? First of all, using color was very, very suspect. Among the scholar artists, they didn't do it. First, a lot of the reason scholar artists refuse or disdain something is because they can't really do it. They never really learn technique. Their whole theory is in some part made up to justify their own practice. But they could use color archaistically. They could use color to refer to some old painting or something. But normally, color just to please the eyes, no. Decorative use of color, no. In Japanese art, that's the big distinction between them. I don't mean to make this too clear, but the Japanese never gave up their love for sheer visual beauty. And you have the great Rinpa Sotatsu Kodi and things. You don't have nothing like that in China, in China. Couldn't happen. But the other thing is that ceramics were made by people who didn't even pretend to be high-class, literati, educated people. They were pure craftsmen.
And so they were happy using color. And since ceramics were functional, you use them on your table or decorative, whatever, it was okay to, you know, have decorative beauty in ceramics. So?
Although the ceramics, the decorations are really lacking in beauty.
No. Well, I mean, it depends on, if you want to take the Chinese literati point of view, like a Chinese scholar, a Chinese critic, you would say, yes, too pleasing the eye, too much, too vulgar. But, in fact, they, you know, made wonderful. I mean, the Song Dynasty, when these great professional paintings were being done, developed monochrome ceramics more than any place else in the world, as you know, to extreme subtleties of color, the celadons and all of that. Yeah. Yes? Oh, we cannot. How do you authenticate an ancient Chinese painting? Okay, we have two approaches to this. Let me say this in the simplest possible terms. The Chinese approach, for which I have the deepest respect, is that you pay a lot of attention to seals and inscriptions and that kind of thing. You read the seals of people who owned it or the artist. You read the inscription. You judge the calligraphy on the painting. And you relate it to the artist's style as you know it. And so forth. And you look at the brushwork. My very good friend, the late C.C. Wang Ji Chen, wonderful connoisseur, one of the two best traditional connoisseurs of our time, shall we say, always said, you look at the brushwork, and the brushwork is like the voice in opera. You don't go to the opera to hear the story because you know the story already. You go for the brush. And then the composition, the scenery, as he called it, in the painting, is the equivalent to the story, which you don't have to pay any attention to. That's one way. The other way, we can judge paintings according to criteria something like what are used in Western art, in the great German tradition, as I was saying. We can establish a period style, or try to, for the late Song period and say this doesn't fit, and therefore it can't be a late Song painting. Recently, as you probably know, there was a terrific controversy over a painting bought by the Met, or for the Met, Metropolitan. Supposed to be by a great 10th century artist named Dung Yuan called Riverbank. And I found myself on the doubter's side, saying, no, this can't be a 10th century painting. It's all wrong. If this is wrong, that's wrong. I gave a paper with 15 counts against this painting, but it didn't convince a lot of people. There's still a lot of people, including the people at the Met, needless to say, who think it's a great early painting. And that one's not going to be resolved easily. I had a dealer friend in Kyoto who recently went out of the Chinese painting business because it was just so hopeless to try to persuade curators and museums that he had a marvelous, genuine painting. There's so much doubt, there's so much difference of opinion, and we cannot easily resolve this. It's much worse than it is in Western art. You do have differences there where somebody will buy a fake whatever, but mostly they agree on particular paintings. That's not true in Chinese painting at all. We're still very, very much, our whole whatever project is somewhat poisoned by the authenticity issue. Do you have any further questions or thoughts? All right.
Over the centuries, there are many instances of Oriental art painting influencing that in the Western world.
Interesting.
Oh,
yes, yes, yes. Oh, there is. Again, I worked a lot on that. In the late 16th and 17th century, when the Jesuits were in China, they brought with them a lot of engravings, some paintings, books with engravings in them. And if you are really interested, my book called The Compelling Image, the first two chapters, first three chapters, go into that quite a lot, more than I had intended. You can match up things done by Chinese artists of that time with Western pictures that were there. Certain things come into Chinese painting for the first time, and they match up with the Western engravings, but you can't find them earlier in China. That's the only way I can persuade people. Now, there are a lot of scholars, including a lot of Chinese, who will only accept written evidence. And they would say, all right, you can say this, but where's your evidence? Meaning, written evidence. And I say, no, the Chinese are never going to write. The Chinese artists will never say, I did this in imitation of this foreign picture. The last thing they would ever think of saying. So you can never find written evidence. So if you want to go that way, you can never prove your point. But you can do it by putting the pictures together and by saying the Chinese artist could not have done this unless he had seen something like that. That's what I tried to do. There's a lot of it. And then in the 18th century, it's very, very common. There were Jesuits working in the imperial court, a man named Long Sherning, who paints in the sort of Western style, Chinese Western. Yeah. Yes?
There are no other questions. Then I'll perhaps ask Dr. Allison Bailey, Director of the Center for Chinese Studies at UBC, to thank our speaker. Before that, I'd just like to remind you that there is no Vancouver Institute next Saturday, the 9th of April, and the final lecture in this year's series, Professor Barry Barish of the Physics Department at California Institute of Technology will speak on an Einstein celebration, Albert Einstein's legacy, our best description of the universe. That's 2 weeks from tonight. Now, Dr. Bailey.
I would like to thank the Vancouver Institute and especially Professor Hector Williams for organizing this marvelous event tonight. Professor James Cahill is one of the world's leading scholars and exponents of Chinese art, and it was a great privilege to hear the inside story of the tensions between the scholar ideal and the pragmatics of making a living, the difference between gentlemen artists and scoundrels. Professor Cahill is internationally renowned for the erudition and elegance that informs his work and on Chinese painting, and his talk this evening is a testament to both his scholarship and obvious love for his subject. He's enlightened and informed us tonight, giving us both pleasure and knowledge, offering us beauty and delight. What more could any one of us ask of a speaker? Thank you very much, Professor Cahill. Thank you.